You're listening to the Hope Shot Recovery Podcast. Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Hope Shot. Hope you guys had a great weekend. I know I sure did. Got a bunch of rest. We just got over being sick and getting the cold out of this house. It's been one of those lingering colds that likes to stay around and gets everybody. Everybody's getting it. The Hope Shot Clarity Statement. We here at the Hope Shot are a group of people in recovery spreading inspiration. We come from all different walks of life and pathways of recovery. Our verbiage may be different at times, but we all have one thing in common. Recovery is a lifestyle. We support all pathways of recovery. It doesn't matter how you get from A to Z, just get there. And thank you for being a part of our family. All right, so let's get right into it. Ryan doesn't have a lot of time, so we got to get right into the story. Let's see, Ryan is if you guys don't know who he is, one of the people behind Mobilize Recovery, which is like an advocacy. They go to Washington, D.C. every year. I know a bunch of our friends that are content creators go to the event that they have in D.C. And he is with Macklemore and Danny Trejo and all those people in recovery that are advocating for better policies in the White House. He is an author of two books, and he's about to have a third one out, but I'm gonna let him come on and share a little bit of his story. So welcome, Ryan.
Justin, it's good to be here. How are you?
I'm good, Ryan. Thanks so much. And thanks for bearing with me with the technical difficulties, which doesn't happen much.
We just go with the flow. That's how it rolls when we do these things.
That's right. We're a slave to the Wi-Fi gods, right? So Ryan, tell us a little bit about how this all began and how you got from the White House and all this neat things that you're doing. Where did it all start?
It's a good question. I got to go back and it's something I reflect on all the time because it just is, it was, I think, several different parts through my recovery journey where I took a turn in it, and it just, they all kind of build up to where you're at today. But really, this is a really interesting time for me, usually in January, kind of holidays to January. So my sobriety date, my recovery date's February 2nd, 2015. So in just a couple of weeks, it'll be 9 years, right? In some respects,
that's my wedding date. Just to let you know.
So we your wedding date and my recovery date. We should celebrate together one day.
Let's do this.
We could share cake. It would be good. You know, in some ways it feels like an eternity ago. It really does. And then in other ways it feels like just yesterday. I don't spend too much time on the kind of the what it was like part, but I'll give you just a short synopsis. I grew up in Miami, Florida. I'm a native Floridian. I now live in Las Vegas. I've been here for the last several years. We're building a home and got married, where we run our nonprofit, Mobilize Recovery, but never really imagined that I was going to become a quote unquote heroin addict. That just wasn't in the cards for me. But as a result of a hiking injury that I had while I was living in Washington, D.C., because as you mentioned in my intro, I at one point did work at the White House in my late teens, early 20s. I had moved back home to Florida, and it was in 2003. If you know anything about South Florida, right, in the early 2000s, mid 2000s, particularly with people with some sort of like pain issue, it was awash with pill mills. I wish I would have known then what I know now, but I can remember going in to my doctor and saying, hey, I had this accident. I was on hydromorphone at the time. I was supposed to be getting outpatient assistance and an MRI and all these things, but I never did that. I just kind of like walked it off and kept going for more pain medication. And my primary care physician said, I don't practice that kind of medicine, but there's plenty of like pain doctors around here that you can go see. And I found one in the back of the Miami New Times, went to it. And that was where I first walked out with OxyContin. I'd never had OxyContin before. Yeah. And the doctor had said, hey, you're taking all of this hydromorphone. You're also on ibuprofen and other medications, not very good for your liver. There's this new medication out that you can take just once every 12 hours. The risk of addiction is very low. It's long lasting. And I remember her telling me, and she's like, it'll help you with all sorts of things. My father had just passed away a couple, like 2 years previous. And she'd said, it'll help with the depression. It'll help with your motivation. I mean, it was like crazy now, like thinking back, and it did, it definitely did. It cured all of it, right? For a short period of time. Now, had I been misusing substances at that point? Yeah, definitely. I was like definitely leaning on the hydromorphone and medications way more than I should have. was I still functional, quote unquote? Absolutely. I still had a job. I was maintaining my own apartment, had health insurance. The relationships with my family and friends really hadn't substantially changed. I was just taking medication, a lot of medication. And I honestly didn't think anything of it at the time. I can remember thinking how great this was. I had this medication with my name on it and it was completely legal. And it honestly felt in the early 2000s, and I think probably a majority of your audience, a bunch of your folks are from South Florida or in Florida, probably can relate. I can remember a time in like the early to mid 2000s, like going to the grocery store, and like we didn't have Uber back then, and like having to take a taxi cab somewhere, and like the taxi cab driver with a bottle of Oxy. It felt like everybody was on drugs in South Florida at that time, or on pain medications. But that Oxycontin really took me down a road, my journey into like full-blown chaotic substance use and addiction, like was not protracted. After starting the Oxycontin, it was like within 2 years, I was unemployable. I was doctor shopping. I had my first bout with treatment. It was within three and a half, four years where I had my first overdose. And pretty much by 2009, you could consider me homeless, unhoused, whatever term you want to use. I didn't have a place to sleep at night. I was couch surfing in and out of ER rooms. Had pretty much destroyed any professional or personal relationship or family relationship that I had at the time.
Yeah, I think that anybody that got a taste of the OxyContin, even regular people, people that are manageable, and it really brings you to your knees. I mean, back then in 2000s, everybody and anybody, and they were giving it out like candy. And yeah, it made you feel like you were defeat the world. You know what I mean? You could do anything. And it definitely cured almost all the bad.
Cured everything. It cured the physical pain, the emotional pain, the trauma.
Everything. You know, if you're insecure, you're secure now.
Yeah. And I had a lot of that I was going through at the time too. So like I was your perfect candidate for a severe substance use disorder. I guess it would be the clinical term, right? Mm-hmm. Chaotic substance use disorder. I had loss in my family that I hadn't processed. I was unhoused. I was unemployable. So things got worse. I was struggling with my sexual identity. I was gay, but it wasn't out and I was like ashamed to talk to anybody about it. I was hiding a lot. I had a lot of self-esteem issues growing up. And the Oxy like really cured all that. Now I know I'm going to jump around, but like, I think back then and like where we are today in 2024, right? I have been going through what I went through then, now I would be dead, not necessarily because of the misuse of Oxycontin, but because people are getting Oxycontin and it's like fentanyl, right? And there's like these fentapills that are kind of all over the place and the drug supply is poisoned. But to wind up what it was like in 2009, like the way I was supporting myself, and I think a lot of us were that were in that kind of culture at the time, was by getting medications, sharing medications with friends, buying back medications, selling your medications. I was seeing multiple doctors. And Florida had seen this huge wave of overdoses coming from Oxycontin and prescription opioids. And so they figured that the best way to solve this and to save lives and to help people was to pretty much cut off the supply. And how they were going to cut off the supply was to institute a new drug monitoring database program that would let doctors know how many doctors patients were seeing, what prescriptions were getting filled, all those things. Nothing wrong with that, right? Like it's known as the PDMP these days. Back in the early days of the PDMP, for CD doctors who were prescribing these medications, it wasn't used to protect the patient. It was used to cover the provider's tail. And I can remember going into one of my doctor's office in full-blown withdrawal and just kind of like, here's my $100, where's my script type thing, pretty much a drug exchange. It was like, it was similar to like an exchange you'd have on the street, except it was in a doctor's office and my drug dealer was wearing a white coat. And the doc said, pulled out this rap sheet essentially of like all the different doctors I had seen within 6 months and was like, I can't prescribe it to you anymore. I'm going to get in trouble, even though this doctor knew what was going on and was also using, and I don't need junkies in my office. If you don't leave here right now, I'm going to call the police and have a trespass order put on you. And I remember thinking to myself, like, this is surreal when this was, I'm like, where am I going to get my medicine? And the power of like choice and willpower and all those things that were taught when we're younger, those weren't there. Those days had long since passed by this point in my life. And I walked out of that doctor's office, and within a couple of minutes, I tried heroin for the first time. This wasn't just happening to me at the time. There were people staking out these doctor's offices, thousands of people across the state of Florida all at the same time. It felt like we were getting kicked off the rolls and everybody was transitioning over to heroin. It was a very quick downward spiral that almost led to multiple instances of death after that. I'll say briefly, by the grace of God and my community, in Thanksgiving Eve 2014, I was on the West Coast at this point and was able to get into treatment, and this time treatment that really stuck for me. It wasn't the most beautiful coastal treatment center you would imagine when thinking about the West Coast. It was a public treatment facility. I oftentimes say by the grace of God and Medicaid, because it was Medicaid that paid for it. And it was because of Medicaid that I was able to get help. And it was the first treatment facility that I actually went to where I was able to get access without shame to buprenorphine and medication assisted treatment, also known as Suboxone, which I stayed on for several months in my early recovery, and really, I think, helped me keep my seat and keep me alive when I really needed it. And I had stayed in treatment for 3 months, and treatment was great and treatment saved my life. But I'll tell you what really made all the difference in my recovery was the day I got out of treatment, which is what I claim is my recovery date, February 2nd, 2015. I walked out with nothing but like two trash bags to my name and nowhere to go. And a local recovery home, Sober Living, gave me a shot and with no money and said, listen, you just come here, you stay here, you stick with your peers, you go to your meetings, you start looking for a job. We're going to help you. Just stay sober, stay clean, do what you got to do, and we're going to help you get there. I had no intention of staying at that recovery house for like longer than a month. I was like, I just want to go back out into the real world. I want to get a job. I want to forget about all this like addiction stuff that happened. I want to get back to what regular people do. I don't ever want to think about addiction or recovery again. I just want to forget this ever happened. I'm not going to use drugs and I'm just going to go about my life. And that's not what happened. I stayed at that house for 18 months, like way past the 1 month that I thought. And honestly, when I left at the 18 months, it wasn't because I wanted to. It was because like the owner of the house and my peers were like, no, you're ready to, like, you need to go take this next step and jump into this fear with a bunch of faith that you have in the community that you have. Now, my journey into advocacy and starting Mobilized Recovery and writing the books and doing the work that I do on the policy level and the political level around addiction, recovery, mental health, housing, ending overdose, harm reduction, all that good stuff. It wasn't necessarily as a result of my own story. My story was pretty frustrating. Navigating the complexities of the healthcare system was really hard. And I think it's hard for most of us when we get there. It's a monstrosity of a disaster, you know, what we have to navigate when we want to get help. It was the result of losing, I think it's a similar story that many people have, losing friends and people I loved, people I went to treatment with, roommates of mine, the circumstances of their death, right? They died of overdoses, but the circumstances of their death really made me angry. I can remember the first one was a friend of mine, Nick, who was actually my roommate. And it was in 2015. It was late 2015, going into early 2016. He had come home from the recovery house high. And I was like a co-manager of the house at this point, like a co-peer leader of the house. And the owner said he needed to leave. And it was 8 o'clock at night. And the last meeting, local meeting that we had in the area had ended at 7:30, and he had nowhere to go. And he said he couldn't call home, couldn't call his mom, couldn't call his dad because they wouldn't talk to him. He had no health insurance. He was afraid to call his employer if he had to go to treatment or get help because he figured he was going to lose his job. He didn't know what to do. And what he did do though, is he walked to the hospital that night, and we had this really big hospital system in the area where I was living. And he went to the ER room and he told them that he was using heroin and that he wanted help. And they didn't even triage him. The nurse at the front gave him a white piece of paper with a bunch of hotlines on it that he could call the next day if he was willing. And he died that night. We actually found him 3 blocks from the house on the sidewalk the next morning. And I can remember getting circled up for our house meeting that day. And the owner of the house was telling us what had happened with Nick. And everybody was visibly upset. And he ended by saying something like, "This is just kind of what happens. Like you get into recovery, make sure you get a suit because you're going to have to go to a lot of funerals, or sometimes people die so others can recover." And I can remember just being really angry at that moment, really sad, upset, powerless. I felt powerless. One of the most powerless moments in my early recovery, and angry. It took me a couple of days to like really realize what was going on. And I didn't accept that. I was like, he didn't have to die. Like he was in the process of asking for help, and he was turned away from an institution, a hospital, something that we're taught to trust from a very young age. Had he walked in there with chest pains, they would have triaged him and probably kept him overnight. Had his blood sugar levels have been going through the roof, they would have kept him and monitored him. They probably would have got him onto some sort of treatment medication, right, for his blood sugar. But because it was heroin and he looked a little different than other folks, they gave him a little Xerox piece of paper that he could try the next day if he was willing. And it was a defeating feeling knowing that's how things still were in 2016. And that was really the moment, if I had to like really pin it down to like an exact moment, where I decided I needed to do something and my community needed to do something, that was it. Now, what happened after that sometimes is a blur for me, because it really started out like this, doing some Facebook Lives. It started out with something called the Voices Project. Like, we had no money. My best friend and I pretty much built what is now known as Mobilize Recovery, which was called the Voices Project when it started, just starting a Facebook page, starting a blog. We rented an RV that summer of 2016 and drove around the country with no money. Literally, we were like GoFundMe gas money as we went, to just go talk to people and get out of our comfort zone and see how things were being done in other communities, what people were doing, what they were hearing, how they were feeling. And we met a lot of folks who felt just like us, that people were being left behind, that we weren't being listened to, that there were things that were working in other communities that weren't necessarily being duplicated in different regions of the country. We talked to policymakers, some who were highly educated and others that were less than educated, I would say, to be kind. And got home from that trip and decided we needed to turn this into something, which is how the Voices Project was born. And started talking about addiction, overdose, our friends, our stories, on social media, and then asking people to do something. And it felt like overnight, things just kind of like blew up, right? It was within 6 or 8 weeks, we had gotten something like 3,000 submissions on our website of people who wanted to share their stories. And it ended up getting picked up in the media and whatnot. And we thought, my goodness, we can't just like have people share their stories and then not harness the moment of what's happening here and asking people to join us and do something about this in their communities. And the Voices Project was born as a nonprofit. And in 2018, really, I think what was the catapult for the organization, which now it was something that started with $20 and a Google, what were they called? It's like a Google tablet that we got from a pawn shop and used the internet hijacked from our next door neighbor of the sober home to like get the organization off the ground, has now blossomed into this nonprofit that has active engagements with about 70,000 members nationally, coalitions in 42 states, media, like bold media partnerships with iHeart and Meta and Google, and advisory co-chairs, like you said, such as Melissa Etheridge and Macklemore and Charlemagne the God and Danny Trejo, and engage with dozens and dozens of members of Congress and the White House and governors and legislatures. And we've worked to help pass over nearly 300 pieces of legislation in different state houses just in the last 2 years around treatment and recovery support and housing and things like that. That all happened as a result of people joining, because it was never about me. It was about us, right? It was about what we could do with our collective power. I think people joining with lived experience, people in recovery, family members, allies, and realizing that we don't need to be an elected official. You don't need to be a doctor. You don't need to be an academic expert. You don't need to be a professor. You don't need to be a treatment center owner to make a real change in your community. Sometimes, like, the best change makers are the people who are closest to the problem, right? Because those who are closest to the problem are also closest to the solution. Sometimes we understand the nuances that some of the smartest people on paper would never be able to understand, right? Like, simple stuff that can be done in our communities. And we just set out with this theory of change that what if more people just like us stepped up to the plate and decided to get a little bit more involved? What would our world look like? And I think that even though the overdose numbers have continued to get to peak up, right, as a result of just this onslaught of a poison drug supply with fentanyl and xylazine and other things that are popping up now, if you really look state by state, the recovery community has made some substantial wins. I think we've also had to get on the defense a lot. And I talked about this at the Floridians for Recovery meeting recently. I think when we started out doing this in 2016, 17, and 18, like, we were very altruistic, right? Safe recovery home standards for folks, low barrier access to treatment, wide distribution of free naloxone, right? This is before it became $49.99 at the pharmacy, really starting to talk about harm reduction and what we need to do to make sure we're keeping people alive, right? Until they find their own personal path of wellness. There was pretty much bipartisan unifying agreement on a lot of these issues. And we've started to see some of that getting backtracked in just the last couple of years and have found ourselves more on the defense of protecting against more criminalization of addiction as a healthcare issue, right? And so it's going to be an interesting advocacy journey, I think, probably for the next 5, 6, 7 years or longer, because what started out as treatment, not jail, right? Not criminalizing a healthcare issue, a public health crisis. Some folks have started to pull back on that and say, well, maybe, like, you know, jail is a better answer because we can't seem to get enough treatment out there. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Sure, lots of people get help through the prison system and the jail system, but that doesn't mean that we should be overburdening our justice system to provide public health supports that our public health professionals should be doing, or that we should be funding to build a public health infrastructure, right? And making sure that people have low barrier access to treatment and housing supports and job training and all the things that you need to do. Like I said earlier, my journey, my personal recovery journey, really took off as a result of having access to housing, having access to peers, being able to get a job in recovery, being able to, like, rebuild pieces of my life block by block. But a lot of the money, we hear about this 50 some odd billion dollars in opioid litigation dollars coming into states. A lot of that money is kind of, you know, people say everybody needs treatment. Yes. Yeah, we definitely need more treatment, but we don't only need treatment. I had been to treatment 8 or 9 times before I finally got it. The reason it happened that last time was, like, yes, it was my moment. And there's a lot more going on in the universe than just what I know around that. But I also know that I had a safe place to put my head at night. I was able to eat. I had some food in my belly, right? I had peers that I was able to lean on. I was able to find a job and get help being trained for a job and keeping that job. Those are things that add to someone's long-term wellness and sustainability and recovery. The U.S. Surgeon General's got a great stat out that says if we can get someone past their 5th year in recovery, sustained recovery, they've got an 85% chance, and this is data-driven, of maintaining that recovery for the rest of their life. Yet our system, as it stands, is really only designed to support people through, like, the acute crisis phase of addiction, right? Like, yep. Someone's in crisis, get them Narcan, get them into treatment. But when you're done with treatment after 30 days, if you're lucky, it's like, you know, we'll see you never.
Yeah.
Next time you're in crisis.
And right now, Medicare, whatever it is, it really only wants to give you 7 days, or that's what I
crazy,
hear.
Which is crazy. There's no crazy. Yeah.
It's like, what are you going to do in 7 days? Like, first it's going to physical. Then you like to get mentally stable. It takes at least to me, that first year is crucial for them to get stabilized to where they can actually believe in themselves and believe that there is another way to get out of the routine of the cycle and keep repeating. Well,
the brain needs time to heal. Like we know a lot about the brain these days and substance use, and the brain needs way more than 7 days to heal. You're throwing somebody out of a hospital or a treatment center at 7 days, you're begging for them to come back if they're lucky enough, right? The system's fundamentally broken. And I think anybody who's been through it or works in it understands that. So mobilized recovery is really an effort to put the voices of those who do the work on the ground, right? Who are on the front lines. I really believe the first responders. We talk about a lot of references to first responders, but when it comes to substance use, when it comes to overdose, when it comes to addiction, 9 times out of 10, the first responders are us, their friends, their family members, their peers. We need to be equipped with the tools to make that change. We're seeing a phenomenon, I think, in 2024. We just launched with our sister nonprofit, the Recovery Advocacy Project, a program, bipartisan program called Run for Recovery. We've got over 30 people, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, people in recovery who are training up to run for local elected office next year. I really feel that that's the next frontier of the recovery movement. There's a lot we can do on the advocacy front, but I think that the folks that are willing to step up to the plate need to really get inside and start helping to disrupt change from inside as well.
And you know, and it doesn't take much. You said right. You started this whole thing with a broken down Google tablet and some Wi-Fi from across the street. And if you don't think you have a voice in recovery, you do. If you have sustained recovery long enough to have you got some clean clothes, got a little color back in you, we all have a voice.
We all have a voice, but I think sometimes that voice, though, like you have to sustain that. Like sustaining this advocacy work and journey for the last 8 years, seven and a half, 8 years. And nonprofit has not been easy, right? It has not been without its bumps in the road. But I've found that when I can get back to that, this is like where recovery principles come into play, right? Like when I can get back to that place of like pure gratitude on February 2nd, 2015, right? Like when I walked out of that treatment center and I found that recovery house and I was able to put my head down there and feel safe for one of the first times in my life outside of a medical setting. When you live in that gratitude and then you lead and everything you do, right, with authenticity, with honesty, with integrity, right? When you always are asking yourself, is this the mark that we should be leaving on the world, right, as a community, with selflessness? When you do those things, it is sustainable, right? Like it does become sustainable. Where I've seen on the advocacy front, and we've seen it with treatment folks and others that like get into more of a privatized corporate setting, and there's nothing wrong with making money, right? I have no problem with that, but people start to get a little greedy. People start to get a little bit selfish. People start forgetting where they came from. People start forgetting why they started doing this work in the first place. They start forgetting that it's not about them, that it's about us. It's about what we can do together. And that's where it goes a little off course and it becomes less sustainable or not sustainable at all. Always remaining true to like your true north and who you are and the principles that got you into this in the first place. That's how you continue on.
I had a good friend and she's an HR person. She always says, you're non-negotiables, right? We all have core values as human beings and we always need to stand on those core values and have non-negotiables. Like no matter what, this is not negotiable for me. And right. I'm going to stand true to myself and true to my purpose and what I started out in the first place. And always remembering those core values as you go into this thing. Ryan, I know you have to go. I appreciate you so much for coming on here and sharing your story and sharing a little bit of mobilized recovery and what you do out here in advocacy. It's very important, man, that we have heavy hitters that are in this thing, winning it for all of us and being out there. So I appreciate you for coming on tonight.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Thanks, Ryan.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, I appreciate y'all joining us. Have a great week. Love y'all. See ya.